Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 224. I'm Vincent Diamante, and it's the whole crew again, which means it's Alex and Mike as well. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm very relaxed. And the reason I'm relaxed is because 2 days ago, I did a 90-minute or so interview on another podcast. And the podcast, I didn't realize this showing up, but it was a video and audio podcast. And it was a great interview. The guy was really nice, and we talked about a lot of interesting things. But I had forgotten how not relaxed you are when you're doing a video recording. Because, you know, you've got this dimension of things you have to pay attention to. You've got to make sure you're in frame. And then if you go off on a spoken tangent, you're like, am I making a dumb facial expression right now? So I'd forgotten. And, you know, as you guys know, this show originated in both video and audio format. And I come to appreciate, since we shifted to audio only, how much more relaxing it is.
Yeah, it's definitely relaxing. But actually, I'm just wondering, I missed out on this podcast. Is it published already? Is it out there for us to consume right now?
On the 31st, I believe.
On the 31st. Okay, so we'll wait until then. Cool. That might be even after the second episode, since you've mentioned this. But whatever, we'll get to it once it's actually out there. That's really cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And yes, I agree. I like how relaxed things are now that we're just audio only. Speaking of relaxed, Alex, you look relaxed over there. How are you doing?
Yeah. See, how did you know? I'm actually sitting here in my pajamas. this is another benefit of going audio only, is that nobody can see how relaxed I am right now in my pajamas here. I'm very well. I am actually especially relaxed today because I took the day off today, actually. Of course, it's the afternoon for both of you gentlemen, but it's 9 o'clock at night, and I'm looking out the window at probably what looks like about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Is 9 o'clock at night currently, as we get close into summer, where the sun doesn't really set very much at all this far up north. But I think I know I say that every episode, don't I? But yes, I'm very relaxed. I had a day off today, and actually, I decided what I would do was just write some music, you know, just for fun. Remember that?
Huh. Oh, that sounds really quite cool.
Yeah, actually, last week, I've had a decent slab of retail therapy researching reverb plugins. And I know we've talked about reverb plugins before, so I guess we probably better not go too far off into this little rabbit hole, very, very deep rabbit hole. But basically, you know, I've been using Valhalla Room this whole time, and I thought that I didn't really need anything else than Valhalla Room. I like its character, and I like what it does, and it's just, you know, I know it quite well. But I sort of started to feel, you know, it might be time to just have a look out there and see what else is going on and the newer developments in reverb plugin technology. And so I went on a little bit of a shopping spree, well, at least some window shopping, so to speak. And my criteria was I wanted a reverb plugin with character as a priority over versatility. So I didn't really want something that could just do everything and was this, you know, all-purpose, everything-to-everyone kind of reverb plugin. I wanted something that had a very, very strong character to it, so that I would know, okay, I want that sound. I know how to get that sound. That was my first criteria. And the second criteria is I wanted something with a fairly simplistic interface without so many tabs and clicking around to get what you need. And I found it. And so today was basically, yeah, just me here with Renoise tracking away and enjoying this new reverb plugin.
Well, let's see. There's a bunch of questions that come to mind. First, I'm just thinking, is this going to be the beginning of a year of exploring reverb plugins as you just go from vendor to vendor out on the interwebs, just seeing what else is out there? Second of all, and actually just stepping a bit back, you kind of hinted at this since you mentioned Renoise. I'm wondering, is writing music for fun, for recreation, a significantly different process or workflow than when you're writing music for work?
Yeah, it's it involves probably about an extra hour of sitting there with your head in your hands thinking, okay, what am I going to write? What do I want to write? You know, so many options. Like, there's so little limitation when you're not working with a game or you're not working with somebody's brief or, you know, some concept art. It's like an open sea. Which direction should I go in? And that is not always so pleasurable for me. I'm sure many people would enjoy that total freedom, but I tend to find that I'm much more productive and much more effective as a music writer when I have some constraints and limitations. So luckily today, because I'd bought this new reverb plugin, I was able to say, okay, I want to just basically put this thing through its paces and, you know, explore all the characters that are possible with this particular plugin. So that was kind of my compass for today. But other than that, other than the wrestling to decide which direction to go in, no, basically the same. It's just, I guess, more fun because, you know, there's no time constraint. And you can just sort of once you get a little bit of momentum going, you can really just let the music tell you what it wants to do next rather than having to think, okay, now I have to do this or do that for these reasons connected to the game. Do either of you guys ever just do that for fun? Just write some music for yourself?
I'll go ahead and start off with that and say it has been a long time since I've done that. It's been a very, very long time. And honestly, I'm currently struggling with how to do that. I actually have a little bit of a vacation planned out a couple months from now. And I'm actually thinking, I want to set something up. Let me lay it out a little bit more. I am thinking about going to the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland in July.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I'm just like, this is a real thing. I'm thinking about it. It's like, okay, I've got, you know, I haven't used any vacation funds in a while. So it's like, oh, maybe I should do something fancy. And then this popped up on my radar. I could go see some jazz artists. But also, Montreux is known for other things besides that. It's actually is the place where Stravinsky wrote The Rite of Spring.
Really?
And I'm like, maybe I should try to do that. Maybe I should actually try to get a room somewhere in a hotel or a B&B and look at Lake Geneva and write music. How am I going to do that? Am I going to bring a notebook? Am I going to bring a laptop with a bunch of plugins on it and my headphones? Or I'm still debating this, honestly. But I do have this gut feeling that I want it to be a pretty significantly different process than my desktop machine with its standard work templates where, I'm doing this. Boom, that's it. It's got to be something substantially different. Maybe it involves a tracker. Maybe it involves a totally different DAW. Or maybe it involves me in Dorico, because it's been a long time since I started a piece of music from the notation perspective rather than from just noodling away on the piano.
Pencil and paper. That's the way Stravinsky would have done it, right?
It's worth noting that Stravinsky had a commission for The Rite of Spring, so he had a kind of deadline structure. And I think it's Stravinsky to whom is attributed the quote about the abyss of freedom. And notoriously, even when he got commissions, he wanted as many parameters as possible specified. So that way he would limit his own degrees of freedom and have something to focus on. So if you're looking for a role model for a kind of open-ended composition with no structure, he may not be the best choice.
Okay.
Yeah, well, structureless, well, let's see, no structure is not the same as music for fun and for myself. And that's really the main thing. Just figuring out a way or a method or a process or a perspective that I'll have in mind while I write something that is not for a job, not for someone else. That's really it.
It's kind of a curse in a way that what we do, because, you know, we're all basically musical chameleons, right? You know, we need to serve the game, and that's our job. And, you know, we're doing our best and most effective work when the music is so perfectly integrated and so perfectly like a jigsaw puzzle, final jigsaw puzzle piece that slots in there for the game. That's ideally what we're aiming for. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the process, what happens to our identity as musicians and as, you know, composers ourselves? You know, I'm sure, like, when I listen to your work, Vince, or when I listen to your work, Mike, I can immediately say, oh, that's so Vince, or this piece of music is so Mike. But I dare say that probably for you yourselves, when you listen to your own music, maybe it's a little harder for you to identify actually what that is when you're trying to vary up what you're doing depending on the game that you're writing for, and you're trying to be as flexible as possible. You may lose sight of your own identity. You may find it harder to hear your own identity yourself, where it is a little bit more apparent to other people. So I've always felt a little bit envious of, you know, full-time art, quote, artist, unquote, musicians, you know, people who just basically sit there all day writing a single style of music that people know is, oh, that's, you know, that's this person, that's this band. In a way, I guess it's a grass is greener on the other side thing, I'm sure. Those people would probably say it's so boring doing this all the time, especially when there's an expectation that your music is going to sound a certain way. They may be envious of our position where we have to be so versatile and flexible all the time. Yeah, I think it's quite a healthy thing to do this like I did today, just to set some time aside and just say, no, I'm just going to not think about it, and I'm just going to make a piece of music that I think sounds good just for myself. Maybe, you know, release it, maybe not. But I think it helps to sort of clarify what is it that I sound like. You know, when I'm trying to do all these different styles, there must be a common thread that other people might hear. So, you know, maybe it's time for me to look for that too.
Yeah, definitely.
There are a couple of really interesting subjects that are all wrapped up here. They interrelate to each other. But the one thing, Alex, that I think is really interesting is the idea of identifying your own style versus, because you're sort of dogfooding your own style all the time, being aware of it versus not being aware of it. And when I was listening to the Space Folk album, I had a fun game, which was try to figure out which cues were yours and which were Vince's. And even though I wasn't 100% successful, I think I was successful more often than not. So I think you must have a distinct style, even when working in this very constrained genre, right? Because the Space Folk album has a very specific artistic palette. And even when I was listening to two composers, you and Vince, working in with that palette, I was often able to differentiate you. So I think you, and probably people in general, have more of a stylistic trademark than they realize.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just all too easy to forget that, and to, you know, from our side of the table, when we're trying to write music, you know, it's interesting that, like, from Vince and I for Space Folk City, basically, you know, the brief was, okay, we have this album, Solid State Survivor by the Yellow Magic Orchestra, and we want to capture something like that feeling. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, that kind of late 70s, you know, early synth pop kind of thing. It doesn't have to be exactly that, but something like that feeling was the brief that Vince and I had decided on. And from our side of the table, we're trying to introduce variety, and we're trying to introduce some diversity in the music that we're producing as we head towards that goal. But, Yeah. As a result, people listening on the other side of the table, or the players, all they hear is, you know, oh, well, that's, you know, that's Alex's music, or that's Vince's music, or, you know. I hope that the goal with that was to make sure that there was a broad palette and it was very diverse. And one of the comments that Vince and I actually quite frequently get for that soundtrack, which is very gratifying, is that people say that it doesn't really get boring, it doesn't get tiring. And I think that's probably because Vince and I are trying our very best to make every song as different as we can, even though it ends up sounding like this is clearly Vince Diamante or this is clearly Alex. So, I think we can easily lose track of what our sound is for whatever reason. And that's a good reason to, to set some time aside and try and find that.
Now, I don't want to get away from this reverb stuff that you've already hinted at, but I do want to ask, though, Alex, if you had to describe your style or your sound, how would you do that?
That's hard, isn't it? So I guess, are we talking about stuff that I do for myself or stuff that I do for work?
I guess however you want to answer that. I feel like this is actually a question that I've been asked in the past that I've always given not 100% satisfying or even correct answers. Like I remember me from 10 years ago being asked this by a developer who I was like – who someone had actually set me up with, saying, hey, you know, you should probably talk to this guy. I bet your music would sound good with them. And he actually asked me, like, you know, what's your style? What's your music like? And my initial inclination at the time was to say, well, it could be whatever, which looking back on it seems like really the worst thing to say. I mean, that really doesn't help narrow it down in their mind or give them an impression of much of anything. I probably should have talked about the things that I enjoy doing. Like I like working with like small acoustic ensemble groups. I really like jazz fusion. I really like the sound of like late 90s, early 2000s romplers. there's some composers that I'm really inspired by. I could have done any of that, but for some reason, the first thing I said was, oh, I could do whatever, honestly, because I was just thinking, oh, no, I just want this gig. but so now I have a better idea of what I would say. But, you know, let's say a developer who you might have a potential relationship with is asking you, hey, someone we know said that I might probably like your music for this game I'm working on. What sort of music do you actually do?
I would say, let's see, anything late 80s or mid 90s electronic with a funky edge, I guess. I suppose a common thread between the stuff that I do is that most of it tends to be kind of funky. I like, you know, things that get your foot tapping and that have a bit of a groove. And I'm a bass player, so, you know, the percussion and the bass line is very, very important to me. But other than that, basically if it's something 80s or 90s and electronic, then that would come very easily to me, I suppose. So, I guess I would say late 80s, early 90s synth. Funky synth.
That's cool.
So how about – we have to go around the table now for this one. And,
yeah.
And seeing as – before we go to Mike, because I'm really curious to hear what Mike would say, but I think we should just start with you, Vince, seeing this, you've had experience with this already, and you may already have an answer that you've prepared, unlike myself, and Mike, who's probably thinking about it furiously right now. So to give Mike a little bit more time, how about you, Vince? What is your style?
I really like orchestras, but I'm also really frustrated with how much bigness and epicness there is out there. So I feel like a lot of what I write is kind of in response to that, trying to go the other way. Very light, very sparse. I like playing around with dynamic music for dynamic game soundtracks that use the orchestra in both a fun way and a realistic way. I imagine the music composer, the virtual music composer in the game, almost like a conductor simultaneously spotting the film that's being laid out by the player and composing to it.
Wow.
Yeah, kind of the feeling that I have. And that's certainly what I think about and try to do from both the perspective of a music composer as well as a technical sound designer and music composer.
Wow. So the Space Folk City soundtrack really was sort of not your usual wheelhouse, it turns out.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the thing. I love that music. Right. Like, I honestly can't get enough of stuff like that. You know, if it's not Yellow Magic Orchestra, it might be something like, I don't know. You know, I've got some Mahavishnu Orchestra that's actually sitting around there. I've got some Future cool. Sound of London sort of sitting around. It's like, you know, I love that music, but that's not necessarily the stuff that immediately resonates with me in terms of what I want to create.
Yeah.
So, but that's still really fun actually making that. It's fun to flex those different muscles, you know, in the pursuit of yourself as well. You know, I'm still trying to figure out who exactly I am and refine that identity and
Okay, Mike, you're up.
What was the question again? Are we just asked? We're being asked to just characterize our style.
Yeah. Like if someone asked you what your music is like, I think within that context of like a mutual sets you up. Here's a game developer who's working on something, and he says, "Oh yeah, it's this person tells me that you know your stuff might match up really well with this game that I'm working on." But actually, I haven't heard your stuff, and this isn't exactly the venue to just listen to it right now. So would you mind talking about it? Like, what is your musical style?
Yeah, I think in a hypothetical conversation, I might draw some from my awareness of what the person's project is. Not to the extent where I would say, like, well, I've always wanted to write music exactly matching the needs of your game. But I'd also look at the person's education and try to figure out what their musical background and context are, and then tailor my answer a little bit. But throwing all that aside and just answering to sort of the universal consciousness, if the universal consciousness's friend had a project and they were going to recommend it to me, and I could answer knowing that they would understand anything that I'd say, I would say my artistic home base is the orchestra. The acoustic orchestra, whether I'm actually working with a live orchestra or a reduced ensemble, like a chamber ensemble, or if I'm emulating an orchestra digitally, I tend to think from those traditions. I was someone who grew up listening to John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith and James Horner and Danny Elfman, and the classical thematic approach is very near and dear to my heart. And some of my favorite scores have that approach where there is some attempt at working melody into the score or thematicity, either overtly or in a subtle way that ties the score together, even though you're not really aware of it being thematic. I'm old school sometimes, and then I like working pencil and paper, even if I'm not working for a live ensemble. Sometimes I'll just sketch out ideas that way or develop them using some of the techniques that the classical composers would. It can be a visual modality for me sometimes, but at my heart, I'm a thematist, I'm a melodist, I'm an orchestral composer, and I try to adapt that language to the landscape of whatever I'm working on.
Good answer.
Nice.
I would not have said that about your music, Mike. I would have said that you are a master of texture. And, you know, it's interesting that, like, the melodist, what were the words you use? A melodist, theme.
I don't know if that's thematist. A word.
Yeah.
It is now.
It is now. A themologist.
Themateer.
I would have described your music as being extremely sophisticated in terms of texture. And maybe that's because whenever we've worked together, it's been usually a case where you know, I've been in the very, very fortunate position of giving you a brief and saying, right, Mike, here's what we're doing. And then you go away and bring that back. And it's usually, you know, spot on for the kind of texture that I had in mind when I described it. So I've always thought of you as being a real specialist when it comes to creating the perfect texture for a game audio soundtrack. So for a game soundtrack, I should say. So yeah, it's interesting how other people's impression of your style differs from your own on occasion. Of course, it's all good, whether you're a melodologist or a texturologist. It's all good, of course.
No, but texture, I assume you mean like orchestration.
Aesthetic texture by the use of an orchestra. Hmm. So I think that if you were not using an orchestra, if I gave you, you know, a bunch of synths and said, here you go, Mike, make me something, I think it would still sound undeniably like you. It's not necessarily the orchestra that is giving that tone. It's your ability to summarize a texture in sound and music. So this is getting awkward now, isn't it? So it's time to change direction. But I actually, well, on this,
you know, I just wanted to say, I get that because, you know, when I think about Mike's music that I've heard, the first thing that comes to mind is the arrangement. I think, wow, this is really good. And that's quite honestly, that's the first thing that comes to mind, is that things are really well orchestrated. So, and certainly, you know, there's really good writing and melodies and themes as well. But, you know, just to sort of, you know, piggyback on that, like that is the thing that comes to mind when I think of your music, Mike.
Well, thank you, first of all. I do love orchestration and thinking of color combinations, although my imagination tends to be orchestral. So when I'm put in like a sound design-y 50,000 artificial kind of hybrid or synth patches, I can sometimes feel a little lost at sea because there are so many options. But I do care a lot about orchestral texture, and the closer I'm going to a real orchestra, the more I sweat those details, I guess.
Mm. It definitely shows.
I'm really eager to ask at this point, how important do you both think it is that a newcomer to our field, somebody, you know, fairly new in the field of game music composing and production, how important do you think it is that person should be able to answer this question? How important is it for them to be able to say, oh, this is my style, like I do this? Is that very important, or is it actually more beneficial for a newcomer to be able to say that first answer that you had, Vince, which is, well, let's talk about your game. What do you need? You know, rather than, oh, I make, you know, late 80s to mid 90s electronic funky music. Like, how is that going to, like, should a newcomer to the industry be wary of being so specific like that? Because it would mean potentially they may lose opportunities to be, you know, getting contracts, because maybe your game doesn't need late 80s to mid 90s funky synth stuff. Maybe you need an orchestra. Therefore, okay, this Alex guy is clearly not the right choice for our project. Is that a bad move to be so specific like that? Or is it a good move? I think I know what my answer is, and I think we've discussed this before. But what do you both think? How important is that question to be able to answer for most people?
I think, in my opinion, that it's really worthwhile to have that, because clear and efficient communication is really good all the way through whatever level of the conversation, the relationship it is. Certainly, we are being asked to be chameleons often, but that's after you get the gig. You know, I think before you get the gig, you want to make things easier. You want to make things simpler for the person to make a strong and simple response to. You know, it feels like, you know, it almost feels kind of like a Dale Carnegie-ish type of thing where you want to frame things in a way so that the person on the other side is given really simple decisions and you reduce any anxiety and having to sift through all the options and information that's laid out there. So if you tell them, well, I can do anything, and well, you're then that person is being asked to do more work and consider for themselves rather than, oh, what do I do? I do stuff like late 90s, early 2000s techno, you know, a la Orbital and Prodigy and that sort of stuff. And then the person on the other side can come to a quick decision, and they would be grateful for being able to do that, especially considering how the process of sifting through applications or going from person to person, conversation to conversation at something like a trade show or an expo can go. Like that's a lot of pressure already. So I personally think that if you start things off in that way, where you have a strong identity that you can quickly and efficiently communicate to a person and they can quickly understand that so that they can quickly come to a decision, I think that's really, really helpful. But that's my opinion. What do you think, Mike?
It's useful to differentiate what you think your artistic priorities and strengths are in the long, dark tea time of your soul, when you're alone, when you're contemplating yourself. I think it's absolutely important at any age to think, these are my favorite pieces of music in any genre. These are the things I strive to do. This is what I think is gorgeous. This is what inspires me. And to have maybe even a secret wish, you know, if I could control the kind of projects I was asked to do, I would do this kind of score 80% of the time, and then the other 20% could be variety. And I really think it's important to have a sense of who you are internally and to cultivate that and to cherish your favorites, even if it's just in the, you know, the privacy of your own mind. The art in dealing with clients and prospective clients is showing opinionation, because I think people trust opinionated professionals, without being so narrow that you cubbyhole yourself out of a project. And I think this is important in particular when you consider the mindset of somebody who is looking to hire someone and has a lot of options. This is something I've encountered on occasions when I've been sort of on the flip side of that process, is that decision fatigue is real. And when you're faced with a lot of options, it's easy to start to look for excuses to eliminate someone. Not out of malice, but just to reduce the decision a little bit. So if you can say, oh, you know what, that person, they're too far away, or they're too busy, or they're going to charge too much because they have so much experience. You know, like whatever your criteria are, there may be a temptation just to narrow the choice a little bit. So you don't want to, getting back to you, the hypothetical composer, you don't want to be so specific that it sounds like a good reason to push you aside out of convenience. So there's definitely value in associating yourself with a stylistic universe, but maybe you can then talk about your process a little bit or your higher level artistic values. One thing I talk about when I'm working on game scores is I'm always looking for the story in the game, even if the game is a strategy game or something that doesn't have a lot of named characters. I'm still trying to think of, well, what is the story here? Is maybe it's just something implied by the environmental design? Is it something implicit in the gameplay? I can talk about that process, and I can talk how it ties to my work in other media as well, like film scoring. And that gives a kind of coherent sense of who I am without my saying, Sorry, man. If you want a jazz score, you should really just hire Vince and not me, because I could never do jazz as fluently as he could, which, by the way, is true. But I don't have to say something like that because I'm putting my opinions on a higher plane. So there may be a value for the hypothetical newcomer coming up with a way of differentiating themselves without necessarily sticking to musical specificity, asterisk, while at the same time having enough musical specificity that you sound like an actual fleshed out human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. That's a perfect answer, I think. I've been really privileged to be on that other side of the table many times, actually, and to have a bunch of options, you know, other side of the table, meaning in the position of looking to contract somebody to do music. And yeah, when you've got in front of you, you know, a range of options, you want, just as you said, Mike, you need to have some process of elimination in that situation. And you don't really want to be in the position of, you know, creating or making it obvious the reason that you would be rejected. However, I think I would encourage people who are just starting out in game audio on the music side, I would definitely encourage you to find that voice and to be able to, just as you said, Mike, to be able to, actually, just as you said, Vince, to be able to express that very succinctly and clearly, because it's similar to the question of what's your career goal? You know, what's your passion? Well, it's a bit cliched now, but it's true. It's cliched because it's true, and that is that it's usually good to try and focus on a career in something that you love. Because, you know, when the going gets tough, and inevitably the going always gets tough, you know, if you have that passion within you that you really love doing this, then that's going to help you in that situation push through those difficulties and that hardship. Well, it's kind of the same. You know, you do your best work when you're having fun and when you are enjoying what you're doing. And I think if you're in a situation where you've said to a client, I can do anything, I'll be whatever you want me to be. You need orchestra? No problem. You need jazz? No problem. You need synth? Okay, I've got you. You know, if you've set that situation up and then the client says to you, okay, well, we need, you know, we need a heavy metal soundtrack. And now you're in the situation, it's like, oh, well, now I have to make a heavy metal soundtrack. And you know within you that, okay, technically I can do this, but I know that it's not going to be as good as somebody who's come in and saying, yes, I specialize in heavy metal, but my range is broad. You know, you're never going to get as good as that. And just the same, like if somebody asked me to do an orchestral score, it's like, well, yeah, I could try. This is not actually what I would say in that conversation. I would say, well, let me go and hire my friend Mike. But no, if somebody asked me to do that, it would be sort of something that doesn't come naturally and very easily to me, which means that I would feel a lot of pressure. I probably wouldn't be doing my best work. It wouldn't be something that I would be very confident in. So just like somebody might say, what's your career goal? And it's good to be able to say, well, I love doing this, so I want to have a career where I'm doing that. I think it's like in a job interview, you might say that, but you also may say, but I learn very quickly. You know, I'm flexible and I'm adaptive and I'm observant and I have a broad musicological knowledge and understanding of music production. So, you know, I do have a range of flexibility that I can apply as well. Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because young people or people new in the industry may be very nervous about being so specific about the things that they really know that they're good at. I make excellent reggae music or hip hop, you know, that's going to really narrow down, nothing to do with those specific genres of reggae and hip hop, but that's good. If you go so specific like that, it's going to really narrow down your opportunities. It will mean that when opportunities do come through for a reggae or a hip hop soundtrack, you're going to absolutely kick it, which is great, but you know, you may not be as lucky as the person over there, one of the other candidates who is, maybe a specialist in a kind of music that's more commonly found in games like orchestral score or synth stuff or things like that. So basically, this is my very, very long way of saying, yes, Vince, yes, Mike, your answers were excellent.
Here's an interesting analogy drawn from the science fiction movie literature. Recall, if you will, a scene early on in Star Wars Episode 4, which most of us think of as Star Wars. C-3PO is being trotted out in front of Uncle Owen, along with a bunch of other droids. And Owen is kind of interviewing them and saying, you know, what are you good for? And C-3PO says, well, I'm a protocol droid and I'm super trained at this. And Uncle Owen's like, oh, I don't need a protocol droid. Look at us. We're in a desert planet. I need a robot who can talk to my moisture bots, right? Which basically is hardware. And 3PO pivots. And he's like, well, so happens that one of my first gigs, I was doing some translation with binary load lifters and their language.
That's
is
right.
A lot. Like, so here's a case of someone who didn't really pay enough attention to contextual and environmental cues and think about what the client's likely needs are and maybe over-specified himself. But he did a decent job of spinning around. And so we might have – and then recontextualizing his abilities in a way that made sense to the prospective client. So you might think of yourself in an analogous position when you're doing an interview is in that you want to try to take in the environmental cues, try to learn what you can from the nature of who you're talking to and just body language and verbal cues and thinking like what is their situation? What are they trying to solve? And do the best you can to tailor your abilities to the perceived needs.
I really like that analogy, but I might suggest that the game industry is perhaps a little bit more hospitable than Tatooine. you know, so, I mean, C-3PO is in a pretty bad situation there. Like, that is their one chance to survive, really. But the games world is really interesting. It's so big and expansive. And Alex, you mentioned a reggae soundtrack. I feel like now more than any other time in the games industry's history, you can find a game that's out there that's being developed for which a reggae soundtrack would be the absolute, totally on-the-nose, perfect execution of the soundtrack. So I guess it is interesting thinking about how often you go through this process. You iterate through and go between different people. And there's different types of places where you'll have different encounters with potential clients. There are explicitly speed dating type industry events where different developers and different providers of different stuff are just sort of brought together and they're rapidly shuffled around so that people might actually find each other. And then there are other types of events, more general things like your, I was going to say E3, but E3 is no longer, that's not really a topic for this show. But other things, you know, Game Developers Conference and, you know, Tokyo Game Show is happening later in this year. And, you know, you iterate through that process and there's so many possibilities that are out there. So I really, really like your answer, Mike. And I was thinking a bit about why I answered the way that I did. And I think it's because when I was starting out in the industry, it actually felt like it was really difficult to come across all of these different potential games that would be coming up. So I actually spent a lot of energy on making sure that I had really strong, really rich interactions with all of these potential clients in order to not ingratiate, but to just make sure that we were exploring all the possibilities out of a potential gig, which is really, really important for me at that particular point in my career. And now it's a combination of where's my career right now, as well as where's the games industry right now, where it seems like everyone is just making every type of game in genres that I actually can't even begin to describe, where it's a hybrid of a hybrid or introducing something totally new that I hadn't seen before. So I guess that's where I was coming from with my particular answer. And yet, I think still, when you showed your answer there, Mike, I think, wow, that actually is, in fact, the right answer. And maybe I need to go back to that.
Also, I think when you are starting out, it's also important to try a whole bunch of different things as well. And if you're able, if you're lucky enough to have the opportunity to try you know, a variety of different styles of music under contract, that's actually even better, even though it's a whole lot more stressful and a lot more high pressure. And of course, the consequences for failing and of course the rewards for succeeding are much greater when you're under contract. If you have that opportunity, it's great as well because, you know, as they say, you can't steer a bicycle if it's not moving forward. And so if you have the opportunity to try orchestral stuff and try reggae and to try metal and to try techno or you know, a whole variety of different things, that'll definitely help you understand, actually, you know what? You know, when I did that reggae game, that was much easier for me than doing these other styles of music. So, you know, that will also serve you well in those conversations where you are, you know, the proverbial C-3PO trying to save yourself from Jawas. Yeah, so it's a, I think flexibility and versatility, it should definitely not be the one way. You know, it shouldn't be, you know, that's the way that you have to be in order to score all of the contracts. Because, yeah, it's very hard to compete with other people if you're trying to be everything and good at everything at the same time. However, of course, as you've said, that you don't want to be shutting out those opportunities either. So, yeah, finding that balance between specificity and flexibility, that's the key, I suppose.
Specsibility, if you will.
Specificity. Now, you realize that neither of you have actually asked me what the plugin is yet, the reverb plugin.
I was going to get to that, but this was such a great conversation. Yeah. Hey, what is this reverb plugin?
as perfectly put like that, so that we could actually sort of edit this section earlier into the podcast. Very nice. Very nice, Vince. No, actually, it was from a company called Reverb Foundry, and it's called Sonsig Rev A. And it is a kind of and it's an algorithmic reverb, which is kind of an emulation of the Lexicon 224.
Hold on, Alex. I'm actually going to stop you there because that's wrong. It's actually from Relab.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. So you mixed yourself up.
Actually, no, you can leave this in because, you know, we're all fallible.
Okay, all right.
It's part of our method.
Yes. Sorry, the reason that I got it wrong there is because Reverb Foundry's HD cart was my second choice. That one is a Lexicon. It's a special kind of expansion board upgrade to the Lexicon 480. It's called HD cart. That's by Reverb Foundry. Yes, indeed, you're right. Relab, I think they're called Relab Development or Relab Engineering. Are the makers of, it's called, they have a Lexicon 480 emulation. Mm-hmm. I think it's the LX480, I think it's called. And one of their other more recent products is called the Sonsig Rev A, which is the Lexicon 224. So, yes, sorry, Relab, if you're listening. They're in Denmark, actually. So I'm in Sweden, they're in Denmark. So all is forgiven. But yes, anyway, so it was the Sonsig Rev A, very, very distinctive interface, which I love. It's great. It's got all the character that I was looking for. It's very simple. No tabs, has one algorithm, no algorithms to choose. It's just, this is what I do. Talk about specificity. This is a plugin that says, this is what I do. This is the way I sound. This is the way I look. You'll know when you need me. It's basically, and it's great. Yes. So, anyway, I said that we were not going to go down the deep rabbit hole of reverbs, and we didn't, but we went down another deep rabbit hole, so I suppose that makes up for it, doesn't it?
How would you, if you could toss around a few descriptive adjectives, how would you characterize the sound of this plugin?
It has that very iconic sort of early digital reverb sound, so it is not aiming to be realistic. It is aiming to be thoroughly artificial, much like those early Lexicon units, and it does that extremely well. That said, it has a bit of a twist on the formula in that aside from just being an emulation of the algorithm in the 224, it actually has a chorus section which functions inside the reverb algorithm as opposed to being something that happens after it. It actually functions inside the reverb algorithm, and the chorus is based on the Selena string synthesizer ensemble chorus. So it's very, very distinctive. You know, the modulation in chorus is something that has to be treated very, very carefully, because, you know, you can actually get to a situation where you can hear the pitch warbling in reverbs. And this one, with this Selena ensemble style chorus, when it's just applied very subtly, really kind of takes that basic digital reverb algorithm sound and kind of makes it very lush. That's the only way I can describe it. So lush, early digital reverb. There you go. That's how I would describe it.
It looks really cool. Have you actually used Relab's other stuff? Because I have seen other people talk about their LX480 as really good if you want that classic Lexicon reverb.
Yeah, I demoed it pretty thoroughly when I was choosing between the LX480, the Sonzig Reve, and of course Reverb Foundry's HD cut. The reason I didn't go for it in the end was, A, I didn't really want something that could be everything, and the original 480 had those four algorithms, you know, the ambience, hall, room, and plate. That's right, plate. I think actually the original 480 had a few other algorithms as well. I think it was maybe six algorithms, the original. I can't remember. I didn't choose it in the end because I didn't want something that had different algorithms. I want it to be one algorithm that sounds really good for that character, you know. But the hype is real. The LX480 sounds absolutely fantastic. And I think right now, at least when I was doing my shopping, which was yesterday, you can actually buy the LX480 Essentials Edition for $35. And that the Essentials Edition basically has only four of the algorithms and very limited control. It has, you know, just the basics like pre-delay, high-pass filter, I think the low-pass filter, I think width and modulation. I think that's all you get. Unlike the full complete version of the LX480, which gives you a whole bunch of different controls. The Essentials version is $35 right now. And yeah, when I was testing it, it's really, really very, very good. It's not for realism. It is specifically that sound, which of course if you like reverb in your music, you'll recognize it from classic songs from the 80s and from the 90s.
I'm a little nervous. I'm a little nervous discussing Relab, because when I tried out the LX480, somehow the Facebook algorithm decided that I needed to see the advertisement for that thing 24/7. So just and arguably that's a really good use of targeted advertising, right? To try to nudge me from being the person who tried it into the person who buys it. But right. It's appeared with distressing frequency on my Facebook feed.
What's your what was your reverb of choice again, Mike?
For when I want a kind of digital algorithmic sound, I have been using Seventh Heaven Professional, which I just really love. When I want a convolution sound, a more natural sound, I still use Spaces 2, which I really like.
That's interesting that you use Seventh Heaven for an algorithmic sound, even though it is kind of a hybrid convolution reverb, isn't it?
Yes. But they've made it so flexible that it kind of feels like you're using an algorithmic reverb. For example, there's a knob for duration, right? And that's something you normally don't get with a convolution reverb, unless you might be able to shorten it just by truncating the convolution sample. But I think there's more mojo going on. So they really went out of their way to try to make it as flexible as it's a convolution of an algorithmic reverb. That's kind of the pitch. Ultimately, I just like the sound of it. It has that algorithmic sound and flexibility, and that's all I care about.
Yeah, it's a very interesting hybrid approach that they took with that, because it's basically loads of impulse responses And then you, the settings that they give you basically morph between those impulse responses. So it's a very smart way to, you know, get some of that customizability into a convolution reverb. And incidentally, the company that makes Seventh Heaven is called Liquid Sonics. Actually, it's founded and run by the same people who are behind Reverb Foundry. And the story was there that they wanted to have their convolution impulse response technology under one brand and their algorithmic reverb technology under another brand, and that's what Reverb Foundry is. So Tai Chi, which is their new flagship reverb, and HD Cart are products of Reverb Foundry, and they're both fully algorithmic.
Interesting.
So this has been an episode where we've said that we're not going to go down a rabbit hole for reverb, and we kind of went down some rabbit hole, and here we are back at reverb again.
Mm. You know, I've been kind of going through my own rabbit hole for reverb, mostly because I've been looking at multi-channel and surround sound reverbs since I've been playing around with music for surround sound. And, you know, up to this point, I've only played around with I've only really shipped things where, oh, you want surround sound? Well, let me at least just do a quad mix and then that's it. But, you know, all the modern consoles these days, they're doing not just surround sound, they're doing 7.1, they're doing height because you've got Atmos. So I've recently been playing around with all the 3D reverbs that are at Exponential Audio, which is under the Isotope brand, which of course is under the new SoundWide brand. And they're kind of expensive. Like, you know, I'm looking at the stuff from, you know, ReLab and Liquid Sonics, and, you know, they can be on sale for relatively cheap prices. Like you were saying, the LX480 Essentials is currently on sale for only $35. And I just did a demo of Exponential Audio's Symphony 3D, which is $600.
Wow.
Which is very expensive. But it's not that expensive if you get it as part of a plugin bundle. You know, where it can be packaged with the new RX9 and Neutron and all that stuff. And because I am a legacy Isotope customer, I can upgrade to that for about $200. And okay, sure, I could probably stand to upgrade from RX7, which I'm currently using, to RX9. That would probably be a good upgrade. So I'm still thinking about it right now. It's kind of scary, actually. All these new reverbs are just so powerful and so there's so much control that I'm struggling dealing with, because for the longest time, my go-to reverbs have been things like Valhalla. You know, I'll just use Valhalla Vintage Verb, and I know exactly how to drive that thing. It's powerful, it sounds good, but it's... more importantly, it's pretty quick to get to where I want to be with that particular plugin. And a lot of these other plugins that I've been experimenting with, they're kind of scary.
Yeah, that was one thing I wanted to kind of avoid with this the criteria that I had for this purchase. I wanted to avoid something that would be so flexible and so versatile that, you know, I'd sit there for 20 minutes just trying to get the sound right. You know, I'd rather have a choice of three reverbs and then say, right, okay, I want that digital, you know, that 80s digital reverb lexicon sound. Okay, I know exactly where to go for that. Rather than, you know, having something that could potentially cover that and potentially do other things as well, I'd rather know, you know, have the specific tool that I would go to just for that. Look at this. It's all this conversation in this episode is all coming around on itself here, isn't it? It's all about specificity and flexibility and the right tool for the job.
True. It almost touches like back. This episode has gone on so long, my concept of time has now become completely diluted. But when we were talking about the SSL having pre-baked opinions, were we on the air or was that pre-show?
Maybe I could figure out a way to put that in the show too. but maybe we should rehash that.
It just seems like it's the same topic.
SSL FlexVerb. Actually, Alex, have you played with FlexVerb? Because you've mentioned some of these other SSL plugins. FlexVerb, I was lucky enough to get on sale a while back. I think it was just $50. And it seemed really nice. And it is pretty nice. I've liked the sound that I've gotten out of it. It's still not quite as simple as something like VintageVerb. And even some of the more robust things that it is more similar to, for example, BrainWorks BX Rooms. I certainly have a facility with that where I can quickly do some more powerful things in there. I haven't quite gotten that yet with FlexVerb, but the stuff that I've done with FlexVerb sounds really good. So again, it feels like SSL is... You know, they're batting 100 or no, they're batting 1,000 right now.
Yeah, I didn't actually try FlexVerb. That one, I don't think I looked at because it looked a bit too flexible, ironically, or maybe not ironically, considering that what it's called, FlexVerb. I didn't really want flexibility. I wanted just character. But yeah, maybe if that's on sale at some point, which probably it will be, it might be worth checking out as well.
We have been going on for a while, so maybe we should go right to conspicuous consumption before we keep on just adding more and more reverbs to the pile. Mike, have you been playing anything recently or watching or listening to anything really cool?
Like most of the world, I've been playing Elden Ring, which is a very absorbing game. I like it tremendously, and I'm not a huge fan of From Software's Souls-esque games to begin with. I always found those were kind of too brutal and unforgiving for me. But Elden Ring manages to strike a balance between being challenging and giving you enough freedom to explore this world so that you can be ready for a particular challenge rather than be forced into it prematurely. So I really like this game. I have some thoughts about how music is used during the game, but I think I'll save them for a future episode because I think that's something I'd be very interested in both of your takes on.
Yeah, that sounds cool. I haven't played enough of that. Maybe I should get back into it, but I'm a little scared to get back into it. What about you, Alex?
Well, actually, my daughter is thoroughly obsessed with Disney's Encanto movie. Uh-huh. And over the past week, I have had to watch Encanto 5 times in 2 languages. And
wow.
I'm very, very familiar with the movie right now. But it's good. You know, it's good. It's very well produced. And the music is excellent. And the sound design is fantastic. It's actually comes from the Skywalker sound team. Did the sound for this. You might notice, if you have the chance to look at it, take note of the credits, because you'll notice that about half of the credits are audio people. Like, there's mostly animators and audio people make up the bulk of the credits. Like, all the music people and all the sound effects people, there's a lot of them. And so, yeah, you may, when you're watching it, it may not be the thing that grabs your attention, the sound design and the, you know, the quality of the music production. But just close your eyes if you need to and have a listen to it, because it's quite impressive, as you would expect for, you know, a movie of that caliber.
Cool.
And what about you, Vince?
Yeah, I've been doing a little bit of playing and listening. So I booted up the Xbox 360. Oh my God. I was about to say Xbox 360. No, I booted up the Xbox Series X for the first time in a while. Maybe it's been 360 days since then. No, not quite that long. But, you know, there is Game Pass, and it is kind of amazing what's being added to that every passing week. One of the most recent additions was this game called Trek to Yomi, which is a really interesting game that has a really interesting older Japanese aesthetic, kind of similar to Ghost of Tsushima in that it's specifically trying to evoke Kurosawa's cinematic work. It's really good. It's a very different type of game from Ghost of Tsushima with the presentation and the way the action is. And the sound and the music are really excellent. The music was actually done by this tag team who have been around in some of my circles in game audio, this one dude, Cody Matthew Johnson, who's really cool, and collaborating with this Japanese composer, Yoko Honda. And the two of them made this soundtrack that is really quite, quite beautiful. And it just pairs so nicely with the imagery in this game. I mean, if you haven't seen it, maybe you have seen it. It's all these very stark black and white, but flat with depth presentations of the action sequences. It's really interesting. And the sound and music that pairs with those images is really good. So if you have Game Pass, I mean, it's a no-brainer to check it out.
Very cool.
That makes it for this episode of the Game Audio Hour. This was episode 224. And thank you for listening. If you are listening right now, that probably means you have a way to consume us, but or maybe you just sort of found us on the web. Well, you can subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Apple, Google, Spotify. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we will give you updates on when the next episode is going to drop, as well as try to retweet some cool voices out there in game audio world. This was an episode. I hope you enjoyed it. So until the next one, bye.